It's the 25th of May 2012, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions: is it nil point for Azerbaijan's human rights record? Are we allowed to say the words London 2012 without prior permission from LOCOG? When is the Festival of the Spoken Nerd coming to town? What's on the menu at the Enlightenment Cafe? And will a segment on breasts be good for our SEO? But first, the usual begging slot. Now, if you listened to last week's show, that you'll know that from now on, we're paying for our own bandwidth on the downloads of each episode, which means every single MP3 which is downloaded of the Pod Delusion, we're picking up the tab for. And as you might imagine, that can get quite pricey. So if you do enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then do head over to our website and subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and will help us keep paying for this and allow us to keep our back catalogue online. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. And don't forget about our partnership with Audible, the audiobooks company. If you sign up to Audible's free trial through our website, then you can download an audiobook to keep forever. It's yours for free. That's pretty good, isn't it? Anyway, on with the show. Now, as you probably know, this weekend is the Eurovision Song Contest. I love Eurovision. The cheesy songs, the silly costumes, and the stifling of dissent by security services of the host nation. Yeah, it turns out that Azerbaijan isn't a very nice place. This came as a surprise to many people, as previously all that we knew about Azerbaijan is that it is a place. Thinking about it, perhaps them hosting a contest full of so many human wrongs should have given us a clue that human rights isn't a priority there. And I guess it puts us all in the awkward situation of wanting to express our dislike of human rights abuses, yet secretly hoping that the Azerbaijan secret police break Jeb Wood's legs. To find out more about the situation there, Liz spoke to Padre Reedy from Index on Censorship. She started by asking him what the human rights situation in Azerbaijan is actually like.
It's not ideal, to say the least. I mean, obviously, we focus on situation for free expression. In the past few years, we've seen journalists harassed by the government. We've seen journalists killed. One was killed last year, a man called Rafiq Taji. We don't know who killed him, but what we do know is the government hasn't exactly been in a rush to investigate his murder. This year, another journalist, campaigning journalist called Idrak Abasov, was beaten up quite severely. This was only weeks after he was awarded an Index on Censorship Journalism Award for his work in highlighting the evictions which have been taking place throughout Azerbaijan over the past decade or so.
And there's been recent protest crushed in Baku over the last few days. Is this sort of business as usual, or have they especially stepped things up for Eurovision?
Well, very much so. The authorities there have, over the past year, been clearing out the centre of Baku to make it more attractive. It's an ex-Soviet country, and you know, it's not a very attractive city by all accounts. So they have been pursuing this policy of clearing people out of their houses in Baku. Often demolishing houses while people are still in them. And they claim that they've been properly compensated and so on, but a lot of people say that they haven't been. So the past few days, people in Azerbaijan have been trying to use Eurovision and trying to use the massive media presence in Azerbaijan for Eurovision to highlight not just freedom of speech, but also the evictions and so on. The evictions, I should say, don't just happen because of Eurovision. It's a policy that's happened for a very long time. The state oil company, which is owned and run essentially by the president's family, rather than, you know, trying to properly compensate people when they're exploring for new oil fields and gas fields and so on, or building pipelines, they just kick people straight out of their houses and demolish their houses. And we're talking about thousands and thousands of people here who have been evicted in this way.
Can activists mount any sort of protest, or is it just that precarious that speaking out leads to arrests and things like that?
A new constitution was adopted in 2005, which technically does allow freedom of speech and freedom of assembly into protest. Unfortunately, subsequent to that, there was no permit given for protest until last year. And that was as a response to, to everyone wanted to look like they were being liberal and nice. Every dictatorship wanted to look like they're being more liberal in the wake of the Arab Spring. But we've seen this week a small protest took place in Baku, and dozens of people were arrested, detained for a few hours, then driven miles outside of Baku to the middle of nowhere and dropped off and expected to make their own way home. Today, Thursday, we've had reports of more people being locked up. These were people who were specifically campaigning for media freedom. They've also been locked up today.
There was the recent Panorama documentary the other day on Baku and Azerbaijan, and there are various people who are just told to leave the country and never come back. Is that an often used tactic as well?
Yeah, I mean, it's the nature of the regime. They do tend to, you know, a lot of people do leave because their lives are just being made hell there. A lot of people are told to leave. So you do have, you know, in London, you have quite a few Azerbaijani people who have either, you know, been politely told by the police that if you, you know, leave now, you won't be harassed any further, or just felt that they had to get out, really.
How does Azerbaijan compare to some of the other Eurovision countries, like Belarus, for example?
If you go to our site, we've got several infographics to explain Azerbaijan's status in the world of human rights, Azerbaijan's oil industry, so on. So Freedom House rates it 139, I think, which is adjacent to Belarus and slightly better than China in terms of everyday freedoms for the Azerbaijani people. So it's not great. And glad you mentioned Belarus, because some people have been saying, you know, it could be even worse next year if Belarus win this. But having seen the song, I sincerely doubt it.
Now that there is like this massive focus, at least for a little while, on Azerbaijan because of Eurovision, is the media treating it differently? Is there more increase in interest?
I think, to be fair, you know, as you mentioned, the BBC show on Monday night, you also had on Monday night an excellent Channel 4 report from Azerbaijan. And if you look, particularly the print media has been excellent in the past few months. You know, you can't expect people to focus on Azerbaijan completely, but I think people have done a very good job. Of course, the question is, once the roadshow moves on Saturday night, Sunday morning, will anyone ever write about Azerbaijan again? Index on censorship would very much hope so. And we will be continuing to campaign and put out more information in the weeks after the Eurovision, just to make sure that while people are still vaguely talking about Azerbaijan, just to push more interest and hopefully get a real groundswell of support for measures encouraging Azerbaijan to promote free speech and human rights.
Do you think it's good that these events get taken to these countries for the spotlight, or does the attention outweigh the harm that's causing in terms of, well, protests is already being stifled, but to a greater extent?
It's an enormously complicated question. And generally, you know, if one looks back over the years of where these things come up, if you look at South Africa being the classic example, one has to look at what the people in the country themselves are saying. You know, we certainly, you know, from day one, I think people in Azerbaijan, since day one, have thought, well, no, we don't want this boycotted. We want this to take place in Azerbaijan. You don't really hear voices saying that. But, I mean, generally, you know, it tends to be down, it's the choice of the people on the ground to make that decision. I don't think it's necessarily helpful to just completely cut off cultural contact with dodgy regimes, because often culture is the way that you get in initially, and then you get to set up dialogues and get talking to people inside the country and get their concerns out.
Also, in the Panorama documentary, it was an interesting kind of dance with the EBU trying to remain apolitical. I was sitting there going, I don't think that's possible in this context. Is it a workable situation for them?
Well, you saw what happened. As I say, it's very hard when you go to a dictatorship, which is what Azerbaijan is, to maintain a stance of being apparently apolitical. It's just impossible because everything about the situation is political. This is what happens when you don't have a proper democratic space where things can be, you know, can simply be freely, where you're free to say what you like and do what you like. Every act becomes a political act. And the EBU, you know, I have a certain sympathy for them because it's not really their place to advocate for human rights. They are a broadcasting union, which has other regimes, such as Morocco, which is a kingdom. You know, it's pretty much an autocracy as well. You have lots of, you have Belarus, as you mentioned, obviously Russia, which isn't looking great. You know, I don't think they can really limit themselves completely, but certainly to pretend that politics has nothing to do with this competition is ludicrous, when obviously the Aliyev family is going to try to at least use it to brighten its reputation, and the opposition are going to use it to draw attention to what's happening in the country.
So Index on Censorship are running a petition that will help people have a guilt-free Eurovision. Can you tell us a little more about that?
That's correct. So, well, we are hoping that on the, you know, the second heat is tonight and the competition is the final is Saturday night. So we're just hoping that on the Saturday night, people will tweet the link to AzerbaijanPetition.org, hashtagging with Eurovision and guilt-free Eurovision is what we're calling it. So, you know, it's just a joke really on how Eurovision is a guilty pleasure, but this is actually something positive you can do for the people of Azerbaijan while watching Eurovision.
So this is a very important question for me, because I'm in the pool with Russia this year for Eurovision. Should we vote for Russia, given that it's got huge issues with its internal politics as well?
Well, I'm obviously going to say vote for Jedward, but the granny's looking good. There was a funny moment, actually, the other night on BBC, where the Italian Nina Zilli, who's another favourite, did mention that she was struck when she went to... when she was being interviewed by Scott Mills, he asked, you know, what do you think of Baku? And everyone's great. And she said, no, it's a very strange place. It's a terrible inequality here. And she started talking very eloquently about the situation there. So maybe vote Nina Zilli. It's not a bad song either. Better than the Grannies.
It sounds very rockabilly, which I quite like, even though it means I will lose the Eurovision pool. That While you're here, would you offer any insight into the more mundane kind of censorship taking place here surrounding the Olympics?
We had the wonderful space hijackers yesterday, who have set themselves up as the official protesters of London 2012. They're a little kind of, little anarchist group who do a lot of fun little stunts like this. And the London Organising Committee for the Olympic Games came down on them like a ton of bricks for using a copy of the London 2012 logo. And they changed the colours, that's all they changed. But it does say London is very definitely the London 2012 logo. And as inevitably happens with these things, when someone tries to ban something specifically on Twitter, this happened that they'd use this. Of course, it backfired immediately with and created far more negative publicity for the Olympic Games and for the organizing committee of the Olympic Games than it had, because, you know, you had, I mean, Index on Censorship broke the story, and then a lot of big profile people, Ben Goldacker, Mark Thomas, Charlie Brooker, all picked up on this really petty and silly piece of censorship.
There seems to be a whole bunch of kind of bad will on the kind of dictatorial regime they have over everything Olympics.
Yes, it's just absurd. And as index.is, it's, you know, we're supposed to have this wonderful open festival where people get together and celebrate human achievement. And you have this, it's an odd thing about all organizations that run major sporting events being seen to the same. FIFA is exactly the same. It's this little closed, vindictive, harsh little world where they must kind of pursue everything relentlessly and everything must be very tightly controlled. And you've seen, the Olympics, London will essentially be run by the International Olympic Committee for a few weeks this summer.
Oh, great.
Yes, let's all look forward to that.
There was actually someone linked us or sent us a link where there is these people who crocheted or knitted something like 14,000 pillows for the athletes, and they're not allowed to give them out because only the corporations can give out free swag.
It's insane. I mean, I've heard rumors that, you know, if you don't have the official, if you're not on the official sponsors network on your mobile, that, you know, you might not even be able to get a signal in Stratford. It's really controlling. It's sadly commercial, but it's weird apart from anything else. It's obsessive. And as I say, it feels dictatorial in that sense, and that, you know, obsession with tiny detail and every single criticism has to be crushed almost.
Anyway, we will put up links to guilt-free Eurovision on the Pod Delusion website. Patrick Reedy, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So you've just heard Podrake mention the slightly draconian goings-on over here, over the Olympics, including a mention of activist group the Space Hijackers, who on Wednesday had their Twitter account suspended by Twitter because LOCOG, who were organising the games, took issue with their using the 2012 logo on their profile picture. This raises some scary questions like, are LOCOG using overbearing copyright rules to censor legitimate opposition to the Olympics? To find out more, I spoke to a member of the Space Hijackers, a man who calls himself Agent Undecided. I started by asking him to explain just what it is that the Space Hijackers do.
Well, we've been around for, I suppose, about like 10 or 12 years, basically being a bit of a thorn in the side for the establishment, if you like, whoever that is, whether it's transnational corporations kind of trampling all over our rights, whether it comes from government. We're basically we're kind of talking back to power, if you like, but with a very, very healthy sense of satire.
The latest controversy that you've been involved in is around the Olympics, because you're the official, you're calling yourselves the official protesters of the 2012 Olympics. What's wrong with the Olympics?
This is the thing. I mean, the Olympics, you can see it almost as being a brand, being the strongest brand in the world in some ways. I mean, it's a really difficult sell to begin to have any kind of critical position against it. People see it as celebration of achievement, etc., etc. And I come from an interesting position myself, because I'm an activist, but I'm also an athlete. So I'm very used to dealing with the positive side of athletics and sport, the way it brings together communities, the way it enhances people's lives, all of these things. All these things are good. You know, there's not really any argument against that. What there is an argument against is the Olympics itself and the way it's run. For a start, the Olympics is organised by essentially an unelected body of officials, and the problem with that is that they get to exercise an awful lot of power over the host nation. So, for example, we've had laws that have been brought in specifically to protect the brands of Olympic sponsors, and that's extending an already extensive copyright law that we have here. They also get to dictate things like how militarised London is going to be. For example, there's going to be, already is in fact, missile bases placed on top of housetops and in our public spaces. So there's all kinds of things like that that are problematic. And then there's the sponsors themselves. I mean, you've only got to look at, I mean, there's very many examples, but look at McDonald's. I mean, how is McDonald's a healthy brand that we should be using to be involved with the Olympics?
So your problem's with the corporate influence of the Olympics, but surely they couldn't take place without these big sponsors?
There is that argument, but look, how big a ceremony do we need to have? I mean, the opening ceremonies of the Olympics are just ridiculously over the top, and they're not so much about celebration of athletic achievement. They're about putting forward the host country as having the economic and political solution to the world. So they're all about that. They're not really anything about celebration of athletics. A celebration of athletics would be a hell of a lot cheaper to do. And something that could be done much smaller scale, but a very much more interesting scale.
So what form has your protest against the Olympics taken so far? I see on your website there's a photo of you all using the 2012 official protester t-shirts in front of the countdown clock. Have you done anything beyond that yet? Have you got any plans for the actual Olympics itself?
In some ways, what we're doing at the moment is we're talking about the control of ideas, the very, very tightly controlled brand of the Olympics. And we're saying that actually there is space to criticise the Olympics. There's room for other stories to be told about it. So that's where we're going with it at the moment. There are very many people out there who are wanting to organise different protests, different ideas. Coming through. What we're going to do, I can't really talk about very much at the moment.
The reason I wanted to talk to you today was because of yesterday on Twitter there was a huge controversy when your Twitter account was banned for using the 2012 logo. So what happened there? How did it all come about?
For the last few days, possibly even the last few weeks, we announced ourselves as the official protesters of the Olympic Games. We realised there was if you like, a gap in the market, something that we could fill. So we decided that's what we would do. And I'd say it's essentially about the very strict and very tight control that is exercised over the Olympics as an idea. And we wanted to squeeze in and kind of open up a space for critical ideas, if you like. So yesterday what happened was essentially when we went to go to our Twitter feed, where we've been talking about being official protesters, we found that we couldn't actually get in. We received a letter from Twitter saying that they'd been contacted by LOCOG, the organisers of the London Games, saying that there was possibility that there could be confusion, that we could be part of the official lineup, which seems a little odd considering we were going to be official protesters.
Do you think LOCOG have shot themselves in the foot here, considering now everyone knows about it?
Well, I mean, that certainly, I mean, it's done us absolutely no harm whatsoever. I mean, we've pretty much doubled our Twitter feed in terms of followers. And in terms of people that have gone to our website, the Protest London 2012 website, and our own website, spacehijacks.org, it's absolutely blown up. And obviously it's been over newspapers, websites, etc., etc. So as far as we're concerned, we've actually managed to open up a space where people are talking about being critical of the Olympics. So it's completely worked in our favour.
In the past, have targets of your protests tried to shut you down in any interesting ways or any other similar ways? Or
but obviously, with what we do tend to somewhat annoy the people that we're criticising at the time. So, for example, in 2009, we rolled into the centre of London in an armoured vehicle as a parody of the over-the-top reaction of police to protest. And the police didn't really get the joke, so they decided to arrest us all for apparently impersonating police officers. A little bit odd, because some of us had bright pink hair, some of us had hair down to our knees almost. Some of us looked a little bit like Wolfie Smith. The charge was ridiculous. It's quite a serious charge, and that we very nearly ended up in court with that, which just goes to show, really, that the powers that be will try and shut you down if you attempt to criticise.
Crikey. So we'll put links to find out more about the Space Hijackers and all of your activities on the Pod Delusion website. It's been fascinating talking to you. I dare say best of luck with the protesting. Agent Undecided, thank you very much.
Okay, no problem, thank you.
Now, at risk of this week's programme becoming something of a censorship special, now we've got Salim Fadli, who's been thinking about the recent ban on access to the Pirate Bay and what it means for censorship and the internet.
Last month, the High Court ordered the internet service provider Virgin Media to block the Pirate Bay. If Virgin Media customers attempt to access that website, they will see a message which reads, "Sorry, the web page which you have requested is not available through Virgin Media. Virgin Media has received an order from the courts requesting us to prevent access to this site." Reveling in victory, a British phonographic industry spokesperson accused the Pirate Bay of infringing copyright on a massive scale. "Its operators," he said, "line their pockets by commercially exploiting music and other creative works without paying a penny to the people who created them." Four more ISPs will be subject to the ruling. BT, Sky, O2 and Everything Everywhere are due to implement some kind of block on the Pirate Bay by the end of this month. That could potentially mean that most British internet users will find access to the Pirate Bay hampered by their own internet service providers. At this point, it's worth providing some context. In case you've never used the Pirate Bay, you can think of it as a search engine whose job it is to index files that are currently being shared. Just like Google, you can go to the site, type in what you want, and a few seconds later, you get a bunch of links. And each of those links, if clicked on, can start a download using an application called BitTorrent. And that's why sites like the Pirate Bay are usually referred to as torrent sites. The important thing to note is that unlike traditional file-sharing services, the Pirate Bay does not actually store the files you might want to download. They just provide links, in much the same way as Google does. The Pirate Bay is just one of many indexes of BitTorrents, and if it were to become unavailable, people could discover the same torrents, or the same content, from a number of other sites. According to the BPI's logic, implementing a block on the Pirate Bay across the UK's top internet service providers will prevent users from searching for these torrent links, and consequently will prevent the users from downloading their precious copyrighted works. And that does seem like a superficially plausible argument, but it fails to take account of the difficulty of censoring anything on the internet. What actually happened when Virgin Media first blocked the Pirate Bay was that a number of national newspapers reported this fact, and a few thousand readers who probably never knew there was a site for getting free movies and music tried the Pirate Bay for the very first time. And the few of those people who were on Virgin and found themselves blocked probably did a Google search and found that there was a very easy way of bypassing the block that took less than 5 minutes' work. The internet phenomena by which an attempt to suppress some content only ends up drawing attention to that which you'd want to hide is usually called the Barbara Streisand effect. It's named after an incident in which the singer attempted to legally sue the distributors of a photo of her home. The attempt to suppress this image caused the image to be so widely distributed that it even reached people like me, who have no interest at all in Mrs. Streisand or where she lives. if the BPI makes news by blocking torrent sites, we can be confident that the result will be that more people know about torrent sites and how to circumvent those blocks. Coverage in the mainstream media proves that there really is no such thing as negative publicity, at least not for the Pirate Bay. So, well done to the BPI for winning your court case. You've just made the Pirate Bay into news again. Perhaps there will be some pod delusion listeners who've never tried downloading a file from BitTorrent, and I hope you'll give it a try. You could think of it as a form of direct action against internet censorship. This is Salim Fadli for The Pod Delusion.
Now, we appear to be living in the golden era for science on the stage. Earlier this week, friends of the show Helen Arney, Steve Mould and Matt Parker took to the stage in London with the latest instalment of their Festival of the Spoken Nerd, a show all about science and maths and nerdy stuff like that, basically. After the show, Liz and I caught up with them and found out what plans they've got for the Edinburgh Festival and a forthcoming UK tour. Hello, so we've just been to see the latest Festival of the Spoken Nerd show, Pi Curious, and we're joined now, walking and talking West Wing style, by Helen Arney and Matt Parker, stars of the show.
Hello.
I thought it was amazing. I know I should be impartial, but that was great.
That was a lot of fun.
I really enjoyed that.
I'm quite exhausted now, so it's not really walking and talking, it's sort of stumbling and mumbling now. Yeah. Thank you so much for going along. We talked about a lot of maths.
Almost maths. Enough maths.
Almost.
Are you pleased with how it went?
Yes, very much. We still always, 5 minutes before we go on, we just stand there and we think, why is anyone here? Like,
why are you here?
I thought I was the only person who enjoyed this stuff, and I found the only other two people who enjoy this stuff.
These people don't know they could use iPlayer, right? They could be at home watching anything they want.
Watching anything. Why are they here? And then you go out there and you're like, they're here because this stuff is awesome! And it's just so much fun to talk about.
I mean, it must be quite exciting for you because, you know, a few months ago you were in a smaller pub, weren't you? And now you're selling out the Bloomsbury Theatre.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
Our old monthly gigs, I mean, because we started with a tiny room, about 40 people,
yeah.
And that was selling out a few months in advance. And so we got to a bigger venue, it was 100-ish.
Yeah.
We can draw a graph if you want. it is exponential. And then the Bloomsbury is 500,
yeah,
and we're doing two nights. So the nerds have spoken.
The nerds have said we want more nerds. And we are happy to provide more nerds. And we're going on tour in the autumn, October, November. We are all over the country. We're also at the Edinburgh Fringe as well, so we're not giving Scotland a miss. 1st to 7th of August, we are at the Edinburgh Fringe doing our first hour show there at the EICC.
What can we expect in these shows?
Things going bang!
It's more than that. It's, so this is our first best-of show, so it's really like a collection of our most top favourite things.
Yeah.
It is dangerous in a lot of ways, and it's a bigger and better version of the little things that we did in our monthly show.
Yeah, so it's we will be blowing stuff up. We will be telling stories about stupid stuff we get up to. And I am also learning how to play the musical Saw and Mongolian overtone singing specifically for this show.
Oh, really?
So that we can put it through a flame tube and see what happens. That's pretty much, we're going to use fire and sound and maths and physics and ukuleles, not necessarily all at the same time.
Of all the top things, this will be the most of all the top.
It's going to be the most top of all the things.
So,
onto Grafton Way.
Grafton Way, if anyone wants to stalk us.
If you want to listen to this podcast, so it's geographically accurate, we were on Way.
We were behind the Wellcome Institute, now we're on Gower Street, we're crossing over to Top Gorge.
Do you want to give your solo shows a plug before?
I'm in Edinburgh doing a show called Voice of an Angle. Yes, that is not a typo, that is me singing songs about science and maths. Matt is also doing a show in Edinburgh.
I've got an engineering show called Humans v Nature, Engineering for the Win. We're on for the first 2 weeks, I think, doing engineering. And then later this year, early next year, I'm doing stand-up maths UK tour. So
I'm not doing a show in Edinburgh, so come and see that.
So that's the whole of August at the Edinburgh Fringe. We will be there, and we will be nerdy.
Lovely. We'll put links to that on the Podlusion website. Helen Arney, Steve Moles. Matt Parker, thank you very much. Sorry, I'm tired, aren't I?
You've got it. Stay quite curious.
So that's what's coming up in the rest of the country, but don't worry, London. In addition to being the centre of government, commerce and unaffordable housing, there's still plenty of culture going on. Next week sees the Old Vic tunnels beneath Waterloo Station turned into the Enlightenment Cafe, which, on the strength of the name alone, sounds like something we should be interested in. To find out more, I spoke to Alex Franz-Koviak, who's behind the event.
The event on the website is described as a Victorian theatrical wonderland of scientific exploration. So what exactly is the event all about?
Well, yeah, I think those words cover it pretty well. It's an adventure for an audience to fall into, stumble into. The Enlightenment Cafe is a science, rational thinking, theatrical project. So it's a theatrical world. We have real scientists inside who will be either doing experiments, demonstrations, or little sort of theatrical talks about real science, about real things that took place during the Victorian era, which was a pretty heady time for scientific discovery and exploration. All eras are particularly, but that was a very, very sort of theatrical one in its essence, really, where sort of psychiatry started. So we have a forensic psychiatrist called Tim McInerney, who is a genuine forensic psychiatrist, who will be actually taking several audience members through psychiatric diagnoses of the time. And then sort of the audience can play around in that sort of like environment. We have a couple of astronomers who are dealing with the astronomy of the time. We have like a fire scientist who's dealing with, obviously dynamite started back in those days, but also the fire brigade. So there's a whole raft of, in essence, very theatrical things that we're putting into one space under a sort of an 1882 banner, and the audience can come down and run around and drink, have a laugh, interact with each other, interact with all the science that's taking place and the theatre that's taking place as well.
Would I be right in thinking it's not like a traditional theatre? I apologise for being a complete uncultured oaf here, but it's not like a traditional theatre where you sit there. It's an interactive thing, so do we walk around to different exhibits?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not just walking around. It's very much a journey that you lead yourself on. We have characters in the space as well, so actual performers as well as the scientists who are creating the world that you'll be coming into. And it's up to you to wander around and use your own sense of adventure, I guess, to explore what's going on in all the little rooms, in all the little spaces that we've turned into the Enlightenment Cafe, into a Victorian version of the Enlightenment Cafe. So it's completely up to the audience member whether they sit there and watch other things going on around them or whether they actually stand up, walk around, get involved with some of the scientists, get involved with some of the characters and some of the little stories that are going to be going on throughout quite a long evening, as it will turn out.
It sounds absolutely intriguing because you've got the old Vic tunnels as well, which are proper old-fashioned underground tunnels, aren't they?
Yeah, the old Vic tunnels is a fabulous space for taking people on an adventure. It's you don't have to do too much to really take people out of their comfort zone, take them out of what they recognize as a normal space. So with a little bit of lighting, a little bit of sound, a little bit of dress, all of a sudden you can create whatever world really you're looking to with a very, very simple amount of tech and design. And with the trains rumbling overhead from Waterloo Station, they sound anything but like trains rumbling overhead. It's really a fabulous sort of multi-sensory sort of environment that you can really play with as an artist and really adds to the whole aesthetic and feel and vibe for an audience member, I think. And that's why the Orbit Tunnels has been so successful, is because it's such a striking venue for people to come to.
It all sounds absolutely intriguing. I mean, what actually inspired you to put the event on?
Well, we've, as a theatre company, we've both come from quite an immersive theatre background. We've both come from a sort of an audience-led journey background as opposed to a sit-down and watch theatre background. So we've always been really interested in playing with the sort of reality, blurring reality with fiction, with imagination, and also not just us completely providing every single step of that on a plate for the audience, but the audience actually having a little bit of ownership of creating some of that imagination themselves. And that's wholly what this is about. And the beauty of science, and we both have a huge interest in science. I'm personally a sort of skeptic of several years now, and I sort of really love the ethos, the rational thought, the measured argument, if you will, of a skeptic. And I think that science really incorporate so much adventure, so much imagination, so much exploration that it leapt out at us when I was listening to a different podcast that was talking about the coffee houses of the 17th and early 18th centuries, the Enlightenment cafes, sort of as they got dubbed. And the whole imagery of that was so striking and so simple that it felt like something that we perhaps bring to now. And rather than us just wholly bringing performers in and wholly bringing in sort of a narrative that is purely sort of make-believe, we wanted to actually take real science and real scientists and on one side have them talk about what they do and what they love and what they're passionate about and bring that passion to stories that they're retelling with real science. So it adds that real sort of level of science communication, but also has that sort of a new and hopefully really, really fun environment for an audience to come and just be involved in.
Excellent, and we'll catch up with you in a few weeks' time because hopefully our deputy editor Liz and I will be coming along. So, I guess let's end with how can people listening come along? When is it all taking place, and how much are tickets and so on?
It's taking place fabulously soon at the end of next week, from Thursday the 31st of May to the 3rd of June, and its doors open at 7 p.m. and there will be scientific and theatrical shenanigans going on until sort of 11 p.m. and later on the Friday and Saturday. Tickets are £15 and you can get them from our website, which is just enlightenmentcafe.co.uk. You'll be able to just buy tickets straight through there.
Lovely, and we'll put links to that on the Podillusion website. Andy Franz-Kovic, thank you very much. Now, over the last few weeks, we've covered some rather strange religions, and this week we've got another. It turns out that psychics and mediums and the like aren't just for middle-aged women watching living TV, but there's a whole spiritualist religion. To find out more, Adam Cuerden has been speaking to his friend Chris, who is a former follower.
Today I'm talking to Chris, a friend of mine who was raised spiritualist in Camp Chesterfield, Indiana.
Hello there.
First of all, Chris, for those of our listeners who don't know that much about spiritualism, can you tell us a little about spiritualism?
Well, spiritualism is the belief that after death, our spirits, our consciousness, still lingers in some form. That sounds like a promising idea, but most spiritualists are also called mediums. They believe, or they claim that they can, communicate with these spirits, sometimes through summoning them, sometimes through speaking for them, or through a whole variety of methods.
And can you tell us a bit about Camp Chesterfield, where you were raised?
Oh, yeah. Camp Chesterfield is the largest spiritual center in Indiana, and some would say the Midwest entirely. It was founded about 1886, and is the home of the Indiana Association of Spiritualists. It was rather huge back in the day, but it's been dwindling over time.
You've left the spiritualist church, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
Can you tell us about some of the reasons why you left it?
Well, I was never exactly a really devout believer, but when I was younger, I saw things that, to a more easily tricked mind, seemed physically impossible. People knew things that they shouldn't have been able to know, or they could read things through closed blindfolds and billets. Over the years, I started looking behind the curtain, and bit by bit, every single belief I had was shown to more or less, typically more, be fraudulent. And eventually, I was left with absolutely nothing that could not be explained away as deceit, fraud, and cheating.
Wow. Can you tell us a bit about some of the things you discovered, some that people who aren't in the spiritualist church might not know about?
Oh, certainly. First, I should say there's two kinds of mediums. There's what's called an open-minded medium. Those are the people who know they're fraudulent and who know they are tricking people. And there's the closed-minded medium. Now, these are the ones who actually genuinely believe they have psychic powers and that they can contact the dead. Now, the closed-minded mediums, they don't really pull too many tricks intentionally. Sometimes they just help themselves a little bit, but it's the open-minded ones who have every kind of trick you could find in magic and more. The most common one is called a blind billet, and that's where a medium puts on a blindfold and gets closed envelopes with questions for dead spirits from the audience. And supposedly they're reading these billets through the closed envelope, never opening the billet until it's time to see what the question was. But in reality, they stay one billet ahead so that they're always reading the next question that they're going to answer, or there's a gap between the blindfold and they can read red ink through a thin envelope.
What's the most difficult one for you to have figured out, do you think?
Well, when I was younger, I thought I had seen a manifestation of a bald spirit. And as I grew up, nothing I could ever find explained that until I found out about luminescent gauze. Now, there's this very thin substance that, when placed under dim light, actually glows. And it's so thin that it can be wrapped up in balls, put into a sock, and hidden in your shoe, or for female mediums in more unsightly places, in case they're going to be searched. That is taken out during the reading, and since it is so dark, you can't see a medium rolling it into a ball and putting it on a thin little wire to move it around the room.
Wow. Can you tell us what some other methods that spiritualists might use?
Yes, one in particular was very widely used on Camp Chesterfield. I was talking earlier about billets, and what a billet is you write down a question to be answered, and you write down to a person. And usually this is not only used in public readings, it's used in private readings. These billets and the answers that are given are almost always saved by spiritualists, and they are handed out to other spiritualists. Because if there's one thing that a spiritualist gets good money on, is it's a return customer. So they have this wide collection of information that they can use to find out exactly who's departed, what questions are being asked, and what answers they can give, so that it's on the same level and it gives an appearance of unity.
What was the part that you regretted most about leaving spiritualism?
What I regretted the most was the feeling of knowledge, that I knew something was going to be waiting for me on the other side. As a skeptic and an atheist, I feel more in tune with the universe as I learn more about it, but it's sort of like having a comfort blanket removed. Now I don't know what's going to happen, even though technically, I never did know. Now I haven't deluded myself into thinking I do know. And of the things I've had to give up, that is the only one I really regret, that a feeling of safe ignorance.
I know the feeling sometimes, I'm afraid. If people want to know more about this, where should they go?
Oh, there's a number of good books that have been written about the subject. I would personally suggest a book called The Psychic Mafia. It was written a couple years ago, and it was almost entirely about Camp Chesterfield, written by a man named Alan Spraggett. It's a very good book and goes in great detail into the frauds, lies, and trickery that the medium community has.
Well, thank you, Chris. I'm sure that everyone will be very interested in this. This is Adam Kjordan reporting for The Pod Delusion.
Now, at risk of turning this podcast into Mail Online, a feature on breast implants. In this next report, Peter English wonders if the NHS should be paying to fix dodgy implants carried out by private companies. Paying for a pair of boobs wouldn't be anything new. After all, the taxpayer does currently pay the salaries of both Baroness Varzi and Michael Gove. Here's Peter English, getting abreast of the situation.
There's been a flurry of activity around PIP breast implants and the regulation of medical implants. I'll ask James to put links to some of this on the Pod Delusion website. In the meantime, it's prompted me to revisit the vexed questions of whether women who have had PIP breast implants should have them removed on the NHS, and whether, having removed the implants, the NHS should provide replacements for them. To recap, people had breast implants done privately. It turned out that the implants contained industrial rather than medical-grade silicone. This rightly caused a scandal. The women had been exploited by a device manufacturer which had fraudulently not provided the quality of product that these people had a right to expect. The government then agreed that women who'd had these implants could have them removed by the NHS at taxpayers' expense. A separate controversy then arose when people were told that they couldn't have the implants replaced by the NHS. I want to consider why all these decisions were made and to ask whether they were sensible. Should the NHS have ridden to the rescue like a knight in shining armour, with the rest of us paying for the horse and all the highly polished metal? Well, it is the NHS, so perhaps armour will be slightly tarnished, but it'll still be perfectly serviceable. I have to declare a bias here. I have a rather old-fashioned view that most people would be happier coming to terms with what they are than through having plastic surgery. I don't personally find large breasts more attractive or sexually alluring than small ones. Rather, I feel rather sorry for women with large breasts, which must be an awful encumbrance. I can far more easily understand why people would have breast reductions than augmentations. Nevertheless, I recognise that many people feel happier for having breast enlargements, even if I, and I suspect many other men, can't fully understand why. And of course, it's not all about how sexually alluring they are. I don't want to criticise the individual women who've chosen to have breast augmentation, but I do worry about the wider effects on society. It troubles me that we live in a society where women would feel better about themselves, or think that they would feel better about themselves, if they had bigger breasts. Not only that, but that they are prepared to take the risks of an operation, undergo the pain, and pay good money for this. This demonstrates how important it must be to them. But I fear that, by having the augmentations, they are increasing the pressure on other women to put themselves through the process too. The decision to manufacture the implants using industrial-grade silicone was an old-fashioned fraud, providing a cheaper, substandard product while charging for the higher quality product that people expect, in the belief that nobody would find out, or that if they did, you'd have spent the money and it'd be too late. It was a crime, pure and simple, in my opinion. But crime or no crime, why should the NHS ride to the rescue like, to update the metaphor, the US cavalry? Well, perhaps the cavalrymen in the old westerns wouldn't be much good at cosmetic surgery. They'd probably struggle to understand the concept underlying the aseptic techniques involved in removing implants, but you get my drift. Whenever the NHS takes over and fixes a problem caused by a private provider, it uses resources that should be spent on treating NHS patients. The operating theatre and its staff can't be doing other essential operations while they're removing a PIP prosthesis, and the money spent has to come out of the already pared-to-the-bone NHS budget. Should caveat emptor, buyer beware, not apply whenever somebody has a private medical procedure? Should people not check that there's some form of insurance to undo the procedure if necessary, and indeed that they can afford to redo the procedures as and when it's necessary, since breast implants may need to be replaced in time, even the best ones? The NHS shouldn't have to pick up the bill when people have complications of treatments done privately. If people can't afford to have the complications treated privately and weren't required to take out insurance to cover the cost, so they end up being treated in NHS hospital, and if it's urgent, they'll displace people with needs that weren't created by their private medical procedure. And yes, I do believe that NHS treatment is often better, medically, if not always in terms of convenience, food and accommodation, than private treatment. And if the NHS does deal with the complications, it allows the private provider to get away with providing treatments not available on the NHS, or allowing people to jump the queue, but still having part of the cost paid for by the taxpayer. Incidentally, this is an issue that we'll have to watch very closely now the Health and Social Care Bill that anybody with an ounce of sense was opposing has become law. Private companies will, of course, tend to pick off the easy bits of healthcare provision, leaving the expensive and tricky bits, including sorting out the complications, to the hard-pressed NHS. But to come back to my question, the answer is that yes, of course, patients should have to pay the full cost of their treatments, including, in a private system, the cost of the compensation that some may be due, and the cost of having to deal with complications and corrective operations when things go wrong. Of course, regulations should be in place to ensure that any business providing cosmetic procedures must pay into a fund to ensure that these things can be paid for when necessary, even if the company doing it themselves goes bust. This would, of course, make the procedures more expensive, as the cost is passed on to the patient, as it must be, or they'll be free-riding on the NHS. But saying all this now is to be wise after the event. We shouldn't delay bringing in these measures, but it's too late for the women who've already had the implants. This doesn't necessarily mean that women with implants should have them removed. Why shouldn't those who can afford it pay for their removal? I can't imagine that in a country like the USA, where private treatment is the norm, the state would put things right when a clinic makes a cock-up. You'd be on your own, buddy. Even if we agree that putting things right should be done by the state, I'm not confident that the recommendation that all PIP implants should be removed is correct. I haven't seen the data on which the recommendation was based. I suspect that it may have been an emotionally driven decision based on distaste at the thought of industrial-grade silicone and sympathy for the women who've been defrauded. I suspect that the risks from this industrial-grade silicone would actually be minimal. But it could be that the decision was based on an objective assessment of the risks of the implants and the cost of treating complications that they cause. If the likely cost to the NHS of sorting out complications is greater than the cost of removing the implants, then removal on the NHS would be a logical, rational decision, at least for those who can't afford to pay for it for themselves. The decision not to replace the implants is another one that's been criticised, but it seems logical to me. This is because it would involve what are known as co-payments, topping up the treatment you get on the NHS with additional services or treatments that you pay for privately. What is wrong with that? Why shouldn't people have to pay to have a little bit extra? The problem with co-payments is that they allow people who can afford to pay to jump the queue or to distort NHS decisions. Allowing co-payments would mean that rich people would be able to pay extra for improvements, for better facilities, better drugs, shorter waiting lists. But if rich people could do this, it's argued, the quality of standard NHS care for the rest of us would slip. Less essential treatments would become available only to those who can afford them, and inequalities in health would widen. It would undermine the universal principles of the NHS. Having said that, I think there may be some situations in which co-payments are acceptable. Perhaps people should be allowed, as they do in France, to pay to have a half bottle of Merlot added to their NHS meal. More seriously, a ban on co-payments has perhaps recently been opposed by people who want to use very expensive and potentially life-saving new treatments that are not available, not yet anyway, on the NHS. Most of us would agree that it seems unfair that if they pay for the new treatment, they should then have to pay for all the other treatments that they would otherwise have received for free. Another context in which co-payments are acceptable, as I've argued in the Archives of Disease in Childhood, is when someone chooses to be vaccinated against, say, hepatitis B. I think they should be able to pay just the marginal cost of the vaccine and have it given at their GP practice, rather than having to pay the full cost of vaccination in a private clinic. After all, if they were to get hepatitis B, the NHS would have to pick up the cost of treatment. The only reason the NHS doesn't pay for everybody to be vaccinated against hepatitis B is because sufficiently few people get it, and fewer still the long-term complications like liver cirrhosis and liver cancer, so a vaccination programme would not be cost-effective. But if people were to pay part of the cost, it would then be cost-effective. Similar arguments apply to other vaccines that aren't available on the NHS. I should point out that other people would argue that the inequalities that might arise if this were allowed would be unacceptable. But for medical procedures, where there's no medical benefit to the patient, and which I think might even harm society, I think the principle of banning co-payments in the NHS is correct. It is logical that it would be inappropriate to replace implants, even if the patient pays, in an NHS facility. This has been Peter English, signing off for the Pod Delusion.
And that's it for this week's show. Remember to check out the Pod Delusion website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to over 2.5 years of archives, as well as follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. And do follow the link on our website to read Liz's article on threats to abortion that was on the Guardian website this week. And do remember, if you have enjoyed the Pod Delusion, then please do head over to our website and subscribe and donate, or make a one-off donation, in order to help us keep the show going. We're paying the bandwidth costs ourselves now, so we're a bit worried they could go mental and we'd be screwed. So please subscribe and donate, so we can keep doing this every week. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Liz Luckendorf, Peter English, Adam Cuerden, Adam Jacobs, and me, James O'Malley, with much additional editing by Liz. The sketch in a moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Well, what am I bid? 10 at the back, 20, 20, do I hear 30, 40, 50 from you, sir, 60, stalling at 60, 70. Any more? Once at 70. Twice. Sold for £70,000. Congratulations, sir. You can now have my exclusive statement about the bribery charges within the anti-corruption department of the police. Now, moving on to the next lot. All the dirt on the arrested Nigerian businessman charged with embezzling millions through laundering money in the UK. Do I hear a starter of 30, 40, 50 with you, sir? 60, 70, 80, 90? Hang on, though. I'm afraid I have an email bidder. That's 150. No more? Right. Well, sold to the email bidder. Oh, apparently a former Nigerian state governor. I just need to send in my bank details. Small transfer fee of £5,000. Right, email that off now. Excellent. Finally, the last lot at the new Scotland Yard police auction. I have a list of media reporters guilty of phone hacking, which will be handed to the Leveson inquiry by the successful bidder. Starting at 10... 7? 5? Oh, you lot have gone very quiet. Anyone to think you journalists didn't want the list to get out?